In the coming four sessions, 4 weeks, I'm going to be presenting for you what I consider to be some of the best considerations from the natural world, from the scientific world, to answer the question of origins. Origins meaning where everything came from, particularly ourselves. There's a variety of opinions about this, but there are two leading opinions that have always been in conflict with each other. The one is what many people consider to be a religious opinion, and of course it does have religious implications. That is the theory of special creation, called special because it suggests that every species, or at least every major group of plants and animals, was specially or individually created, and not that one creature was created and later evolved into others and so forth. Special creation suggests that there were separate acts of creation of each individual category of animals and plants. Now, whether we divide those categories into the normal speciation that's, you know, that the modern scientists talk about, species, or whether it's a somewhat broader categories, we don't know. It's quite clear that species are not altogether static, that a great deal of variation takes place. Every species has a sufficient gene pool to allow for a tremendous amount of variation, usually for the sake of survival in changing environmental conditions. But nonetheless, the special creation position is that every specific major group of creatures, animals and plants, was specially created and has its boundaries, its limits to how much it'll change. And that there is something called the fixity of types. Some would say the fixity of species, but I'm not sure I agree with the current view of what a species is. But fixity of species is usually a fair enough thing. It suggests that no matter how much changing goes on within a species, it's never going to change into another species. Or if in some slightly different species, certainly not a different type of creature. You can find, for example, cases of populations of field mice which got isolated from their relatives in separate fields and don't interbreed, and which change enough through mutation and through their breeding populations and so forth that they no longer can interbreed with the with related population across the street or whatever, or at the other end of the field. And this is pointed to usually as trans-species evolution taking place, because it suggests that a new species has been formed because they can't interbreed. And see, here the problem is that we're defining species somewhat arbitrarily. Not a bad definition, but still arbitrary. We're saying a species is distinct if it cannot interbreed with a creature of another defined species. That is, they can't interbreed so as to produce viable and fertile offspring. So this is what creation, special creation, has always taught, that every major type of creature has been put here separately. Now, the implication, of course, is that there's a divine mind or designer who has done this, and this, of course, has always lent itself to religious views. Views based on the Bible, views based on the Quran, views based on other religious literature often include a creationist explanation of origins. Biblical people, I myself am a Christian, I'm not going to be talking about the Bible tonight, I'm not going to be talking about Christianity. That's not the announced topic, and we won't get into that topic. But as a Christian myself, I believe in creation. I believe in special creation because that happens to be the view that's held by Christians. But it's not only held by Christians. A lot of other religious faith hold to some form of creation. And there's even persons who are not committed to any particular religious faith, but because of the evidence, which we should be looking at, have come to the conclusion that there must be a mind, there must be a designer, there must be some intelligence that actually did put the major species groups here. That does not always lead to Christianity, and much less to fundamentalism. But it does lead to the idea that there's design and implied purpose. Now, the other view that has always been around, ancient Egyptians and others have held to it, was evolution. It wasn't always referred to by that title, but basically the idea is there was not a special creative activity that produced each type of creature or plant, but the more complex forms developed from previous forms that were somewhat less complex, and that there's an interrelation of all species. At least modern evolution teaches this, that all species are interrelated from a common ancestor. And, of course, that's suggested by even the term relationship. If one species is really related to another species, because they're the family relationship. They go back somewhere, if you go back far enough, to an ancestor that formed both branches of their family tree. And, therefore, interrelationship is a key tenet of the philosophical view called evolution. And that creatures evolved from previously existing creatures is an idea that's been around for centuries, millennia. However, it wasn't until 1859, when Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species, that there was now a scientifically plausible explanation for how this could have taken place. Now, you see, prior to Darwin's publication of his book, both views were manifestly religious views. There was no evidence, there was no mechanism, no naturalistic explanation of how one creature could evolve into another kind, nor was there any naturalistic explanation of how they could be created. Both suggested miracles or supernatural intervention or something that just doesn't happen in nature. What Darwin contributed to the debate, and of course it really became a hot debate with the publication of Darwin's work, what he contributed was finally a scientific-sounding explanation of how naturalistic processes, that is, those that do not involve any intervention from a supernatural source, could account for the great diversity of plants and animal species that exist today. Darwin's view was, because he was a theist, but not a, he had been a Christian, but he renounced his Christianity, but he still believed in a God. He believed that a God had created the first living cell. This is stated in the last paragraph of the early editions of his book, that the first living thing was put here by God and began to develop. But that thing had DNA, it had reproductive potential to diversify. Its offspring would not be exactly like itself if there were mutations that took place and so forth. And that this would give rise to a variety of creatures from one single original. There would be a variety through the process of genetic mutations. That would happen, inevitably. Maybe not all the time, but he figured we got billions of years to work this out, so that eventually there would be quite a variety of single-celled creatures. And eventually, somehow, the barrier would be leaped from single-celled creatures to multicellular creatures. Now, by the way, to the average man on the street, that doesn't sound like such a big problem. After all of us are multicellular, and we all started out as a single cell. So what's the big challenge for a single-celled creature to become multicellular? It happens every day in the womb of metazoa, or in the eggs of metazoa. A single cell develops into many cells. The problem is, of course, to describe how a creature that is a self-contained protozoa, a self-contained one-celled creature, could develop into not only many cells, because single-celled creatures do divide in many cases and become two, but how they would become joined into one organism and diversify into muscle cells, brain cells, bone cells, blood cells of various colors and so forth, how a cell with a single DNA organization could produce cells that are entirely different from itself for entirely different functions and somehow be joined to it inseparably so that the community of cells, as it were, becomes a single organism. Well, and that is actually a problem for evolutionists. It doesn't get talked about so frequently because it's not their worst problem. They have many others that they have to talk about a lot more. But that is a problem, and it doesn't exactly... There is no scientific explanation. It's just hoped that this happened. In fact, it's affirmed that this happened because, after all, there are multicellular creatures. They came from somewhere. And since we cannot allow special creation, we have to assume that they came from a single-celled creature, despite the improbabilities and the scientific impossibilities involved in that. But once this single cell became a multicellular creature, of course this was an invertebrate, a creature that has no skeletal structure, because a skeleton is a complex and apparently designed structure. And the simplest multicellular creatures, according to Darwin, would be far from complex, far from having symmetry of their parts and so forth. They would just be like jellyfish or corals or things like that. Eventually, however, these two, through the process of mutations and through variations, gave rise to new structures, including internal skeletons, and eventually all the diversified organs of the higher organisms, so that not only did we get a lot of cells that can somehow survive in a community into a single organism, but we have tremendous diversifications in highly complex systems, the nervous system, the brain, the digestive system, the incredible reproductive system of any creature. I mean, the higher the creature, the more incredible the system that when you consider it. And anybody who's studied these things knows exactly what I'm talking about, although one can hardly guess how they can still believe in evolution once they've considered these things. But to the evolutionist, anything is possible given enough time. And whereas the creationists always said, In the beginning was God, or Creator. The evolutionary idea now, which is unashamedly stated by many evolutionists, is in the beginning was hydrogen. Now, of course, if that is true, if hydrogen gases actually were the source of all living things, then we could define hydrogen as a colorless, odorless, tasteless gas, which, given enough time, becomes intelligent human beings. And that is essentially what evolution teaches. But since that doesn't sound very scientific, they have to come up with a procedure. And the procedure is this. It's called natural selection. Darwin taught that in any generation of a species, there would be a tremendous variety, very small differences between them. Perhaps the runt in a litter of kittens would be an example of the kind of diversity that would be within a single generation. Maybe different colorations of certain siblings within a litter. And some of these would be more fit for survival than others. Perhaps if they had protective camouflage coloring, they would be more inclined to survive in the struggle for survival than others. They'd be more viable, which simply means able to survive. And they would have an advantage in the struggle for survival, and they would therefore survive while their less fit siblings would be killed off. And therefore, those that were most fit would survive. Those that had characteristics that were most congenial to survival would carry on and reproduce their own type, and their own type, of course, their own offspring would have a variety, maybe very small amounts of variety, but the very strongest and best of those would survive, and basically each generation would become somewhat, maybe immeasurably, superior to the previous generation, because only the best and the brightest and the strongest of each generation would survive in the struggle for existence. The weaker ones would be killed off. This actually does take place. This is what Darwin called natural selection. Nature was selecting which specimens of every generation would survive and selecting them by giving them advantages that others did not have. And the survival of the fittest is another way of saying natural selection. And natural selection does take place. Most of you may be aware that in the wild, many predators prey on the weakest of the animals of a group of antelope or deer or whatever, cheetah and lions and so forth. Often they try to pick out, before they even make their charge, they try to pick out, if they can make out by observation, which wildebeests or which zebras are already kind of weak, slow or whatever, and those are the ones that tend to get picked off. And, of course, that helps increase the general quality of the herd, because the weaker ones that would presumably reproduce weak offspring, they get killed off, and the stronger ones that can escape lions and so forth survive, and they produce, we would imagine, at least to some degree, stronger offspring, so that it maintains the higher quality of the species. Now, that is something that creationists have never had any difficulty with. The main bone of contention between creationism and evolutionism is that evolution suggests that natural selection not only selects and eliminates the weaker of a particular generation, but that natural selection somehow has the power to innovate totally new structures, totally new organs, and ultimately totally new types of creatures. Now, Darwin believed that these changes happen only extremely slowly, over millions of years, that it would take, for example, for a reptile to evolve into a bird, with all the changes that would involve, that might take, 100 million generations. And each generation would only have a tiny, tiny little change from the previous generation, so much so that if you saw two generations or even 10 generations from each other, there'd be no measurable difference. But the changes are tiny. They might be microscopic changes. They might be internal. They might be genetic changes. But over the long haul, the accumulation of zillions of indiscernible advantages that were accumulated would create something altogether different than the ancestor. Now, one thing that evolutionists have been absolutely unable to prove is that could ever happen or that it ever does happen. And this brings us to the question of what is science? Because the evolutionary mainstream likes to paint the picture in this way. There are, in our day, two opinions about origins. There is the creationist and the evolutionist. The evolutionist is the scientific opinion. The creationist is the religious opinion. Now, since most scientists are fond of equating the word science with truth, it's quite clear that if you hold the view other than the one that they label the scientific position, then you are holding something that they would label something like the superstitious tradition. And if, in fact, this is the case, if science has demonstrated evolution to be true, and all it takes is a lot of blind faith to hold any other view, then I'd say honest people ought to go with evolution. I would. I want to be very honest with you. I am a person with religious beliefs, but I'm not so committed to those religious beliefs that I believe them against all truth. And as a matter of fact, I could believe in evolution if it was proven to me, to my satisfaction, and still not be dislodged from my basic religious beliefs. And many Christians have done that. They have included evolution in their view of the Bible. They just simply say, well, evolution happened. God just made it happen. They're called theistic evolution. I'm not with them, but I could be without, I mean, I don't have a dogmatic approach that says I cannot believe in evolution. My position is the evidence is all against it. If the evidence was in its favor, I could go with it. But the publicity on this subject usually indicates that only a small number of religious people still doubt evolution. All scientific people know better, that evolution really is true. Which means we need to define what we mean by science and what we mean by faith. Faith, sometimes in the mind of scientific people, means something like superstition. But that's not what it has historically meant, even among religious people. Faith is simply putting confidence in a reliable object. Those who believe God is reliable, and therefore they put their faith in Him, they believe in Him. They're not being irrational, because all persons tend to put faith in that which they think to be reliable. Whether it's a teacher, whether it's a theory, whether it's a religious idea, whatever strikes you as reliable, sensible, and mostly likely to be true is what you will naturally tend to put your faith in. Faith is not an irrational activity. It may take place, it may go beyond what can be proven. Once you've established that a certain source of information is reliable, you may trust it even when it says things you can't establish by experiment. But you hopefully will have a rational reason for judging that source to be reliable. If you have no rational basis, then you are involved in superstition. My personal belief in God is based on what I consider to be extremely rational consideration of the various options and the data in favor of them. But I believe that evolutionists are very much involved in a faith system also. Creationists certainly are, because they believe in a creator that has never been seen, never been observed scientifically, and according to their views, couldn't be. A creator that is not even in the world of nature, and science only studies natural things, and so it would never be able to verify or falsify belief in such a being. But science, on the other hand, is a very narrow field. Although it is often defined differently than I'm going to define it, the true definition of empirical science is that which conforms to the scientific method. There is an established method known as the scientific method, and most of the older textbooks on science, and I don't know about the newer ones, probably a lot of the newer ones too, stick very closely to the empirical definition of science, which is this. Whatever can be tested, observed, and demonstrated through use of the scientific method is science. Whatever is not subject to the scientific method may be true, but is not science. There are areas from which we glean information out besides science. Not everything is in the realm of science. Now, the scientific method is as follows. There are several steps that must be there, or else you don't have the scientific method. First of all, you have to observe a phenomenon taking place. You have to observe the same phenomenon taking place repeatedly, because repetition is a basic part of forming a hypothesis. You observe repeatedly the same phenomenon taking place, and having observed that phenomenon and noticed it, you hypothesize, you create a hypothesis. This is a step in the scientific method that suggests you make an educated guess that the thing you have observed to happen regularly will happen universally and in every case. And it's happening because there is some kind of a law of nature, maybe as yet undefined, but there is something making that happen. And you make a hypothesis that this will always happen that way because there's some force in nature there that I'm going to try to discover. Now, the hypothesis is an educated guess based on repetition of observations. But once you have this guess, this observation, hypothesis, you test it. You subject it to experiments. And the experiments are supposed to be objective enough that they could either verify or falsify your hypothesis. The hypothesis has to be specific enough that you would know what you would predict in an experiment. If this hypothesis is true, then experimentation should yield such and such results. If my hypothesis is not true, then the same experience will give other results and will falsify my hypothesis. If the hypothesis cannot be verified by experiment or falsified by experiment, it is not science. It doesn't belong to the realm of empirical science. But if you have experimented on a hypothesis and you always get the results that you expected, then you can begin talking about it as a theory. You have to be very willing to change your mind. You have to be very open-minded to allow the evidence to lead you where it will. The problem with science is that it's not conducted by robots, it's conducted by human beings. And human beings have something in their nature called preference, philosophical preference, ideological preference, sometimes even religious preference. And virtually everybody on the planet has an idea that we could call a religious idea. Even those who are atheists have a religious idea. That is their religious idea. There is no God. That is a religious idea. It's not a scientifically testable idea. You can't go into a laboratory and determine whether there's a God or not. That is a religious idea. And a person is welcome to hold that idea. An atheist is entitled to his opinion, just like a person who believes there is a God is entitled. But he's not entitled to say that's a scientific pronouncement. All human beings are subjects, and therefore they are subjective. And there is a certain amount of subjectivity that enters into the way that data is interpreted. There are usually paradigms, which are structures of belief into which data is often shoehorned and forced, even if it doesn't fit nicely, because the paradigm is considered to have priority over the particular data. Once a particular thought paradigm has been accepted, evolution is such a paradigm, so is creation. We can call it a model if we want to, a scientific model, the evolutionary model, the creationist model. Once the model has been found, you go looking for the data, and you try to see whether the data fits this model or that model better. Unfortunately, though, there are people who are so committed to one model or the other, they don't care what the data really is. They'll find a way to shove it into the model they prefer, whether they're creationists or evolutionists, which means that we're really dealing with very flexible kinds of science here, if this can be called science at all. You see, the real problem is that the question of origins is not a question of science, really, in the final analysis at all, because it's not a question about what happens in the natural world. It's a question about what happens when no one is there observing it. No one sees evolution taking place. It isn't happening. It's true that peppered moths, you know, populations vary in color and so forth. That's not evolution. That's not Darwinian evolution taking place. No one has ever seen anything like the transformation of one kind of creature into a radically different kind of creature, which is what evolution says happened, but no one's observed it. Therefore, it's not really in the realm of empirical science. It's not happening. Not happening visibly, anyway. Nor has anyone seen creation take place, because according to creationist views, that happened already. It's not happening now. It's not observable. We're talking about historical issues, not scientific issues. We're talking about what happened, not what is happening and can be expected to happen. Because no one is observing either creation or evolution, neither is really subject to the scientific method, because observation is the very first step. So when we talk about evolution and creation, we're not talking about science in its purest form at all. We are talking about philosophy. And when those philosophical paradigms are established, then the data can be measured against the paradigms, and it is possible to go to the realm of science and say, listen, if my philosophy about what happened is true, what would I expect to find in the natural world? I'll go and see if it's there. The creationists can do that, and the evolutionists can do that. But the fact is, the data does not prove what happened. For instance, if a scientist could go into a laboratory and actually make a fish turn into a frog, by a series of, you know, mutations and experiments that were done, and be very remarkable, and be a leap forward, no pun intended, be a tremendous leap forward for evolution. Because, I'll tell you why, it would show that it can be done. If a scientist managed, through the application of all his knowledge of science and all the technology available to him, and all the millions of research dollars given to him by the federal government, that if he managed to transform a fish ancestor into a frog descendant, what he would have done is shown what no one has ever done yet, that such changes are possible. It's never been shown that that's possible yet. He would have, it'd be a quantum leap in favor of helping evolution gain credibility. But you know what it would not show? It would not show whether that happened in nature or not. It would show that now, through intelligent design and intelligent intervention, which is exactly what creationists postulate for the introduction of all things, is intelligent intervention, what a scientist would prove thereby is that through intelligent intervention, such a thing could be made to happen. But the question of whether that's where the first frogs came from anyway, Or whether this happens in nature without intelligent intervention is a separate question that cannot be addressed by that experiment. All that experiment can do is show the plausibility of the suggestion. You see, the question of whether we got here by evolution or by creation is one that, in the final analysis, is not really going to be determined in a laboratory or through scientific evidence. But we can certainly go to science and say, does the natural world and what is found there fit well into the evolutionary framework, the evolutionary model, or does it fit better into the creationist model? And what we are ending up with is there's two faiths. There's a faith in evolution, something no one's ever seen happen, and there's a faith in creation, something no one's ever seen happen. But we can see what's happening now, and we can see by checking the fossil record what happened in the past, and we can determine which faith is a more reasonable faith. So do not get me wrong. I do not intend to prove creation occurred. But I do intend to show that creation, when all the evidence is considered, is a far more reasonable faith than the naturalistic evolutionary faith is. Which brings me to one other point I have to make an explanation of, then we'll get into the data itself. I said naturalistic evolution. I also said earlier there are theistic evolutionists. There are religious people who believe in God, who believe that evolution occurred and that God directed it. This is not permissible in modern science. Because modern science, when it says that evolution occurred, means naturalistic evolution. And naturalistic means no intervention from supernatural forces. Do not make any mistake about this. Evolutionists, the mainstream evolutionists, are not open-minded on this question. They sometimes, when they're trying to show their fair-mindedness, they're willing to say, you know, evolution's not really in conflict with religion. You can be a religious person and still believe in evolution. But you really can't believe in evolution, as they say, because if you read their books, Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker, is a case in point. One of the most touted and most highly recommended scientific books by a popular writer in England, a popular English zoologist. The scientific community raved about his book as the most convincing modern treatment for proving Darwinian evolution. Published in 1987, I think, or sometime around then. The book doesn't prove evolution at all. All it does is try to prove there's no God and that you can still believe in the origin of things without believing in a God to create them. What he seeks to do is try to show that evolution is plausible, but he doesn't present any evidence in the entire book that it ever happened. And this is the best, of course, evolution can do, and it's also the best that creation can do. We can't go back there and prove that creation occurred. That's why we are willing to say this is a faith system. The problem is that evolutionists are in exactly the same position, but they're not willing to admit that theirs is a faith system. At least most of them are not. Now, as we look at this evidence, some of you might say I'm a little unfair, because what I'm trying to do is demonstrate that creationism is the most reasonable faith based on scientific evidence. But it may appear that what I'm doing is nothing more than showing that evolution doesn't fit the facts. I've sometimes been criticized for this. They say you're taking an entirely negative approach. You're not proving that creationism occurred. You're just showing that you don't believe evolution could have occurred, or that it occurred, and that the scientific evidence is not in favor of evolution. Therefore, you've not done anything toward establishing creation. I disagree. This is a quotation that comes from a book called Science on Trial by D.J. Fatuma. The man is, or was, one of the most articulate and convincing defenders of evolution against creationism. In fact, the book Science on Trial is all about defending evolution against creationism. The book is a sustained argument against creationism. Now, he made this statement, which I agree with, in his book. On page 197, Dr. Fatuma said, quote, "Creation and evolution between them exhaust the possible explanations for the origin of living things. Organisms either appeared on Earth fully developed or they did not. If they did not, they must have developed from pre-existing species by some process of modification. If they did appear in a fully developed state, they must have been created by some omnipotent intelligence." Now, that's a reasonable man speaking there. At least in this paragraph, he's reasonable. He's not reasonable throughout his entire book, but he's got it right here. These are really the only two options. Either things like people and animals and plants appeared here suddenly exactly as they are, or they didn't. I mean, those are the only two options, right? So you, one way or another, living things and the universe itself must have come into being essentially as it is now, without very much change, or there's been a great deal of change. Those are the two options. One is evolution, one's creation. Now, when I say creation, I'm not necessarily arguing for a literal interpretation of Genesis chapter 1, as the fundamentalists do. I don't mind saying I am a fundamentalist in that sense. I do believe in a literal interpretation of Genesis chapter 1. I don't mind wearing that label. But one doesn't have to be a fundamentalist, does not have to believe in a literal interpretation of Genesis chapter 1 in order to be a creationist. A creationist differs from an evolutionist only in this respect. The creationism at base is the view that there is design and purpose in the universe. That it's not an accident, it was design. It's not meaningless, it was purpose. Those are the two contentions that really make a person creationist. Regardless of what he thinks about the way things came about or who the being was that brought him into being, what differs between creation and evolution at the very base is that the evolutionist insists there is no design and there is no purpose. Now, both statements are not scientific statements. Those are philosophical statements. Do you understand that? And yet, scientists are very fond of telling us that we cannot bring philosophical or religious ideas into the discussion of origin because science is knowledge. But you see, scientists, after they've said all they can, still are left to interpret the data in terms of their basic philosophical predispositions. They are either materialist, naturalist, or supernaturalist. There's either all these things came about through natural processes that should still be operating today, there's no reason they would have stopped, or else some of these things came about through processes that are outside nature, supernatural, that are no longer taking place. These are the two options, and the creationist view is that there is design and purpose. The evolutionary view is there is no design, there's no purpose. Anyone who reads Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker, realizes that that's all he's trying to prove. He's just trying to explain away that which appears to be design. It's not design. It's not as if a watchmaker made this watch. It was made by blind forces, just by accident. And basically, that's the evolutionist who has that axe to grind is obviously committed to a religious position. He doesn't call it a religious position because that would make it sound less credible. But it is a religious position, and some are willing to say so. Now, Dr. Fatuma said, creation and evolution are the only two choices there are, and he's quite right. Therefore, any evidence that can be brought forward against creation is, ipso facto, evidence in favor of evolution, the only other option. And evolutionists know this because most of their arguments for evolution are not positive arguments for evolution, but negative arguments against creation. Stephen Jay Gould said the best evidence against creation is imperfections in the natural world. In fact, he once said, if there were no imperfections, we would have no arguments in favor of evolution over special creation. He believes the only remaining argument that makes any sense against evolution for evolution is simply an argument against creation. If there's an omnipotent, omniscient creator, he wouldn't have done it this way. That's what Gould said about the panda's thumb and a number of other oddities. Hen's teeth and dangling toes on pigs and things like that, you know, that never touched the ground. These are imperfections. No divine creator would ever have made things this way. And this is supposed to be proof of evolution? What is it? It's simply a statement against creation. But evolutionists know darn well that a good case against creation is by itself a case for evolution, because those are the only two possibilities. But then they complain. If we say, well, let us show the case against evolution, they say, oh, but that's no positive evidence for creation. You say, the argument against creationism on this basis is unfair. We can't prove what happened, but many times we can prove from the evidence what didn't happen. And if we can show that evolution did not happen, we have thereby proven that some form of creation occurred. We may not have proven our particular brand of it. If I can prove to you that evolution did not happen, I have proven that creation occurred, but I have not necessarily proven anything about the Bible or Genesis or my particular view about how creation occurred. What I have, however, demonstrated is that evolution is not the answer. Creation in some form is. Likewise, if an evolutionist can prove that creation didn't happen, then he is left with no other option but that evolution happened, and so forth. So I agree with Dr. Fatuma on this point, and therefore some of our arguments will be favorable toward creation, some will be negative against evolution, but the net result of all of them is that it proves the same point. Okay? Let's go on to the next quote there. I'd like to show you the kind of intimidation that Darwinists like to resort to in trying to make their view the only view on the field. Because their view doesn't compete well against opposing teams, they have to make sure theirs is the only one on the field. And this was from one of the leading evolutionists until his death in the late 60s, Sir Julian Huxley. At the time of his death, Julian Huxley was probably the world's leading evolutionary authority. And he made this statement back in 1960. He said, "The first point to make about Darwin's theory is that it's no longer a theory but a fact. No serious scientist would deny that evolution has occurred, just as he would not deny the fact that the Earth goes around the sun." End quote. Now, if you took that at face value, of course, it'd be crazy to say that evolution didn't occur, because obviously we know for a fact that the Earth goes around the sun. And if no serious scientist would deny that evolution occurred any more than they would deny that the Earth goes around the sun, then we must assume evolution has been proven to the same extent as these facts of the solar system have been proven. Well, so it is often said, but we shall see that he is not exactly telling the truth. I'm not sure if he was misinformed or simply dishonest. But I'll take another quote to show that he's not the only evolutionist who talks that way. This one comes from Richard B. Goldsmith, who I mentioned earlier. He made this statement back in 1952 in American Scientist Magazine, Volume 40, page 84. He said, "Evolution of the plant and animal world is considered by all those entitled to judgment to be a fact for which no further proof is needed." This is the ploy that is so often used. You agree with me, or else you're not entitled to have an opinion. Evolution of the plant and animal world is regarded by all those who have a right to an opinion to be a fact. No further proof is needed. Therefore, since 1952, no further evidence has had to come forward to prove evolution, because it has been proven beyond the shadow of a doubt by that year. And anybody who thinks otherwise just isn't even entitled to have an opinion. Talk about religious fervor. Talk about religious dogmatism. Evolutionists are chief in this particular field of making dogmatic statements without basis. And this statement, like others that we'll see, are without basis. Here's another quote. This one from Richard Dawkins in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. It's 1986. I said 87 earlier. Published in 86. He said, "It is absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that," unquote. Interestingly, he goes on in the next paragraph to say what he likes least about creationists is how intolerant they are. So it's nice to see that not all hypocrites are in the church. But the fact of the matter is, this is the way evolutionists have talked since the early days, and obviously Dawkins is a good example. In fact, they still talk this way. Here's a quote from Dr. James Watson, famous for his joint discovery with Francis Crick of the double helix formation of the DNA molecule. In his book, The Molecular Biology of the Gene, Dr. James Watson said, "Today the theory of evolution is an accepted fact to everyone but a fundamentalist minority." That means narrow-minded people who believe in the Bible, whose objections are based not on reasoning, but on doctrinaire adherence to religious principles. This statement made many decades ago by somebody who said, no one believes in creation anymore except a bunch of bigoted religious folks who are not reasonable. They're not willing to listen to reason. They're not basing their views on reason. They're just blindly loyal to the religious traditions. Well, it may have seemed that way to some of these older evolutionists back in the 50s and 60s, because there weren't an awful lot of scientists coming out of the closet saying, hey, I don't believe in evolution either. Now there are thousands. Thousands. There's a creationist society of scientists out of Michigan that has over 1,000 members. The one in San Diego has several hundreds. All these men are men with graduate degrees in science, professional scientists, who all say, creation is a better explanation of the facts. And then, of course, there's an uncounted number who are not religious in orientation, who still doubt evolution, but they just don't talk about their doubts because it's not a good career move. And there have been a number who've lost their jobs at the university, not because they were religious, but because they doubted evolution. And if you think I'm not telling the truth, you simply haven't kept up with the news. And so perhaps Dr. Watson, Julian Huxley, Richard Goldsmith, some of these people might have, in fact, thought it was true that no scientist doubted evolution because no one was talking about it. Richard Dawkins should know better, though. There are some very serious scientists who are not stupid, insane, or wicked, who seriously doubt evolution, and not all of them have any religious agendas. Some of them do, I admit. Some do not. But the fact of the matter is, we're not getting a true picture here from these men. In fact, here's a quote from W. Scott Morrow, who's a biochemist at Wofford College in South Carolina. He describes himself as an evolutionist and an agnostic. Okay, he's not a creationist by any means. He's not a religious man. But interviewed in the Oregonian February 7, 1987, he said, "Creation scientists offer affirmative evidence based on paleontology, comparative morphology, probability, genetics, and comparative unrelatedness. These involve scientific data and do not involve religious concepts." Which, of course, indicates that one does not have to be unreasonable and doctrinaire, bound by doctrinaire adherence to religious principles to think that creationism has some merit. There are scientific concepts that are not religious in nature that even this agnostic and evolutionist biochemist says he acknowledges. Creationists do come from that way. Another instance is from Dean H. Kenyon, quoted in the same edition of the Oregonian, February 7, 1987. He is a professor of biology at San Francisco State University, not a creationist himself. He says, "It is my professional opinion that creation science is as scientific as evolution, that creation science is as non-religious as evolution." Now, what he's saying is both views have about equal claim to being called scientific, and both views are open to the same charge of being religious, because both of them are making statements that have never been observed and can never be observed, as near as we can tell, and do not submit themselves to the scientific method, so they really are faith statements anyway, both of them. But we shall look and see which is a more reasonable faith. Let's go on to that next transparency. A guy named Dr. G.A. Kerkoop from the Department of Physiology and Biochemistry at the University of Southampton wrote a book back in the 60s, actually 1960, called Implications of Evolution. He was a leading evolutionist at the time, and I believe still is. I haven't kept track of him since then. But he basically was writing a book in defense of evolution, in which he made this statement. He said, "There are seven assumptions which every evolutionist has to make. If you don't make these seven assumptions, you're not an evolutionist. These are fundamental assumptions inherent in evolutionary theory. They are as follows. One, spontaneous generation occurred, which means that the first living thing was not created and designed by an intelligent creator, but actually came about from non-living original chemicals. And that a living thing was produced from non-living stuff." Now, the irony of this is that spontaneous generation was the prevailing notion of science until Louis Pasteur came along and proved otherwise. No serious scientist today would listen to an argument if you said you have proven spontaneous generation occurs. And yet, while they don't often think about it that clearly, if there is no creator, then spontaneous generation must have occurred at least once. The second assumption is that it happened only once. Why is that inherent in evolution? Because the evidence for evolution is considered to be that all creatures are related to each other, that all living things share certain things that would not have arisen independently. Like every living thing is made of cells. Every living cell has DNA. And DNA is a highly, complex design thing. And the likelihood that DNA would evolve separately and independently twice is inconceivable. But that the original thing might have had DNA and passed it along to all the other species that evolved from it, that's not inconceivable to the evolutionists. And therefore, they believe that all living things that have DNA must have come from an original living thing that had DNA. That means that spontaneous generation can happen once. It can't happen any more times than that. No matter how many billions of years there have been, it can happen, but it can only happen once. And it did only happen once. And the third assumption is that viruses, bacteria, plants, and animals are all interrelated. Now, that is, of course, an assumption. When you see two creatures that look a lot alike, you might assume that they're interrelated, but that may not be at all true. A marsupial bat is not really even considered to be closely related to a placental bat, which is the kind of bats we have in this country. Marsupial bats carry their young in a pouch like a kangaroo. They're found only in Australia. They look, their body shape, their overall appearance is very much like, almost identical to the bats of other parts of the world. The only thing is that marsupials are not considered to be anywhere near related to placental mammals by evolutionists. Their appearance, the likeness, is simply deceptive. Even the evolutionists would not suggest that the similarities in their appearance suggest close relatedness. In fact, these are supposed to represent what's called convergence evolution, where creatures that branched off somewhere way back there before any of them looked like bats evolved separately in two parts of the world, and lo and behold, both developed body parts that are exactly alike, except for the reproductive system. Everything about them is exactly alike. And they say this is a phenomenon called convergent evolution, which means that evolution took place over here and over here totally separately, but happened to take exactly the same course and reach the same conclusions. Interesting concept. Never been proven, and hardly seems likely to people who are not already biased in favor of it. But nonetheless, it is something that has to be accounted for by evolutionists, and they believe everything's interrelated. They think that whatever all creatures have in common with each other, protoplasm, DNA, those kinds of things, is evidence that they are related to each other. That is, they came from a common ancestor. Fourthly, it is assumed that protozoa gave rise to metazoa, which is just another way of saying that creatures that are consist of only one cell gave rise to creatures that consist of many cells. We already mentioned something about the strangeness of that concept and how unlikely that seems, and certainly no one's ever seen that happen. But, by the way, science requires that you see something happen, but no one's ever seen this happen, but evolutionists all assume that it happened. It's their religious conviction that it did happen. The fifth assumption is that various invertebrate phyla are interrelated, which means that all the creatures that don't have skeletons, jellyfish, insects, crustaceans like lobsters and crabs, sea anemones, mollusks, clams, you know, snails, all these creatures are interrelated to each other. All right? Then the next assumption, the sixth, is that the invertebrates gave rise to the vertebrates. So, at one time, the sea was simply full of creatures that had no skeletal structure. But one of these somehow gave rise to a whole new class of creatures that had a complex defining skeleton, internal, that protected the internal organs, that gave shape and structure to the body. Somehow, a creature that had none of that gave rise to creatures that all have that feature. The invertebrates gave rise to the vertebrates. And then the final assumption, of course, is that fishes gave rise to amphibia, which are like newts, salamanders, frogs, toads. Those are the amphibia. And those gave rise to the reptiles, which, of course, are the lizards, snakes, crocodilians, the turtles, and the tuatara of New Zealand. And that the reptiles gave rise to birds and mammals, and they would classify humans in the class of mammals. Now, these are the assumptions. Now I'd like to show you what Dr. Kerkhout said about these seven assumptions. We'll take that quote there. In his book, Implications of Evolution, after listing these seven assumptions, which he said all his colleagues, including himself, as evolutionists, have to make, he said, "The first point I should like to make is that these seven assumptions, by their nature, are not capable of experimental verification. We have to depend on limited circumstantial evidence for our assumptions." A little later he says, "There is the theory that all living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. And the evidence that supports it is not sufficiently strong to allow us to consider it as anything more than a working hypothesis." End quote. This is from a leading advocate of evolution, but an honest one at this moment. He's saying, you know, we make all these seven assumptions, and that's all we can call them, assumptions. They can't be observed. They can't be verified experimentally. They are simply circumstantial evidence that we base our assumptions on, he said. Well, it's nice that evolutionists occasionally tell the truth like that, because that is obviously the truth. I mean, as soon as you see what he says, you can say, oh, clearly he's telling the truth. That is right. But why is it then that so many evolutionists say, well, we've proven it, we need no other evidence? You know why? Because they've got a religious agenda. An atheistic religion is what they're promoting, but it is an agenda. And you can see that it blinds them, just like some fundamentalist Christians' religious agenda blinds them. There is dishonesty on both sides at times. I should hope that we could avoid the dishonesty of either position and just say, listen, let's let the facts lead where they should, to the truth, whatever that may be. Well, look at another quote. This one comes from another leading evolutionist, L. Harrison Matthews. He is not a scientist of little note. He is a fellow of the Royal Society in England, one of the most prestigious scientific associations in the world. So much was his evolutionary thinking esteemed that he was asked by the publishers of the 1971 edition of Darwin's Origin of Species, he was asked to write the foreword. Every once in a while, Darwin's book is reissued with a new foreword by a contemporary evolutionary expert. L. Harrison Matthews was asked and did write the foreword to the 1971 edition. And this is what he said in that foreword. This appeared in between the pages of Darwin's Origin of Species, 1971 edition. Dr. L. Harrison Matthews made this statement, quote, "In accepting evolution as a fact, How many biologists have paused to reflect that science is built upon theories that have been proved by experiment to be correct? Or remember that the theory of animal evolution has never been thus proved. The fact of evolution is the backbone of biology. Biology is thus in the peculiar position of being a science based on an unproved theory. Is it then a science or a faith? He answers the question, belief in the theory of evolution is thus exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, but neither up to the present has been capable of proof. The theory of evolution is so plausible that most biologists accept it as though it were a proven fact, although their conviction rests on circumstantial evidence, it forms a satisfactory faith on which to base our interpretation of nature. There's another honest evolutionist talking. It's nice to know that some are honest out there. He says what he would probably like to not have to say. Don't you think, as a leading advocate of evolution, he'd like to say, this view of mine has been proven beyond the shadow of a doubt? He says, hey, you got to remember, it hasn't been proven. It's circumstantial evidence. Same expression that Dr. Carrick used in the previous quote. Circumstantial evidence won't hold up in court, or at least it's not considered to be strong evidence. He says it's a faith. It's just same as creationism in that respect. They're both faiths. They are both faiths that a person adopts and then interprets nature through those faith systems. Well, in Nature magazine, Drs. Paul Ehrlich and L.C. Birch made this statement, and they are evolutionists. They said, evolution is therefore outside empirical science, which is what I said earlier, though not necessarily false, because they believe it's true. They say no one can think of ways in which to test it. Ideas, either without basis or based on a few laboratory experiments carried out in extremely simplified systems, have obtained currency far beyond their validity. They have become part of an evolutionary dogma, accepted by most of us as part of our training, unquote. Now, these guys are adamantly opposed to creationism, yet they say evolution is a dogma. Dogma isn't part of the scientific method, like hypothesis and theory. Dogma is a religious word. It talks about doctrines that are held to for reasons other than proof being available for them. They are faith systems. So here we have some leading scientists saying, hey, it's a faith system. Now, someone might say, well, that's just the minority of evolutionists willing to say that. Most of them say it's been proven by science. True. But one can see why an evolutionist would claim that his view has been proven. One cannot see why an evolutionist would claim that his view has not been proven unless he was telling the truth. One might expect some people to shade the truth in favor of their view. It's hard to imagine why they would shade the truth against their own view. And therefore, the testimony against themselves is much stronger, even though there's fewer men willing to admit these facts, than a host of men saying, my view is perfectly correct and no one can challenge it. You know, I don't care how many people say that about their view. I'm interested in knowing how many experts are saying, well, it's not exactly that way, and being a little, obviously, more honest. Here's a quote. It comes from Errol White, one-time president of the Linnaean Society in London. The Linnaean Society is a society of prestigious taxonomists, those who categorize animals and plants into their various family groups, based entirely on evolution, of course. Although Linnaeus himself was a creationist. Linnaeus, the father of taxonomy, was a creationist. But modern taxonomy is based entirely on evolutionary theory. And the president of the Linnaean Society in 1966 was Errol White, and in a presidential address he made this statement. I have often thought how little I should like to have to prove organic evolution in a court of law. The recent researches by workers like Dean and Henschelwood already suggest the possibility of incipient cracks in the seemingly monolithic walls of the neo-Darwinian Jericho. For a non-religious man, it's rather interesting that he uses so many biblical allusions. The neo-Darwinian Jericho, does anyone remember anything about the story of Jericho? What happened to Jericho? It fell down. And it sounds like he thinks that maybe Darwinian evolution is sort of looking at the same fate. There's already, he says, incipient cracks in it. And many researchers have tended to demonstrate that. He says, I am glad I'm not the defense attorney for evolution in the court of law. Here's a quote from Colin Patterson. This man is the senior paleontologist at the British Natural History Museum, the author of the museum's general text on evolution. Very committed to evolution. He gave a lecture at the American Museum of Natural History in 1981, in which lecture he said these words, speaking to a group of evolutionary experts, and he is the most expert in the group, speaking as an expert witness for evolution. He said, "Can you tell me anything you know about evolution, any one thing that is true?" He says, "I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer I got was silence. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar in the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists, and all I got was a silence for a long time, and eventually one person said, 'I know one thing, it ought not to be taught in high school.'" By the way, Colin Paterson got called on the carpet by his colleagues for making these statements, and in a later edition of the lecture, he removed this paragraph. But he made this comment in that lecture in 1981. Okay. One of the most dogmatic evolutionists writing today is Theodosius Dobzhansky, a very leading vocal opponent of creation and advocate of evolution. In the Evolution Journal, in 1975, the June edition, he wrote a book review on a book called The Evolution of Life by a scientist in France named Pierre P. Graffet. And this man is one of the leading voices inside the evolutionary community against evolution, Graffet. But he wrote a devastating attack against evolution. And Dobzhansky, in Evolution Journal, reviewed the book, and he said this in the review: "The book of Pierre P. Graffet is a frontal attack on all kinds of Darwinism. Its purpose is to destroy the myth of evolution as a simple, understood, and explained phenomenon." Now, one can disagree with Grasset, but not ignore him. He is the most distinguished of French zoologists. His knowledge of the living world is encyclopedic. The sentence with which Grasset ends his book, misspelled Grasset there, is disturbing. And he quotes the sentence: "It is possible that in this domain, biology impotent yields the floor to metaphysics," unquote. Dobzhansky found that a disturbing quote to give. Grasset is saying there is no physical or material or natural explanation that could make evolution be true. He is the leading zoologist of France. His knowledge of the living world is encyclopedic. In fact, Grasset is the editor, general editor of a multi-volume set of encyclopedias about the natural world. He is the leading expert of France on the subject, and he totally rejects Darwinism. So, in spite of what some of these guys like Richard B. Goldschmidt and Julian Huxley said, there are some serious scientists who would deny that evolution has occurred. Not all of them are committed to doctrinaire adherence to religious principles. Some of them are just flat-out good scientists who know better than to believe in evolution. Now, this quotation comes from Dr. Anthony Ostrich, professor of anthropology at St. Mary's College, South Bend, Indiana. This comment was made when he was speaking to the 9th International Congress of Anthropological and Ethnological Sciences in Chicago. And the statement is as follows, quote, "The Darwinian evolutionary theory has been promoted by only a few leaders in anthropology and human biology, but the vast body of professionals have fallen in behind them for fear of not being declared serious scholars or being rejected from serious academic circles." In other words, if you don't fall in behind the leader, it's vocational suicide for a scientist. A few leaders have really promoted the thing. The rest follow in knee-jerk, lemming-like, blind loyalty to the orthodoxy for fear that they won't be included. They can't publish articles in the journals. If they don't publish, they perish. I mean, there's strong, strong pressure upon anyone who's trying to make a living in the scientific world to go along with the paradigm of evolution, even if you suspect it's not true. This, unfortunately, does not encourage progress to more acceptable explanations of things, but that's one of those things. Science is not quick to change its views, even when Galileo, according to legend, proved that objects of different weight and size fall at the same rate, thus disproving the scientific orthodoxy of the time, which thought that heavy objects fell faster than light objects. Galileo allegedly dropped two such objects from the Leaning Tower of Pisa for an observing company of scientists, they saw that it happened the way he said it did, but they went out and wrote articles ridiculing him, saying it wasn't true. Why? Scientists change slowly, if they change at all. Scientific orthodoxies die hard just like religious ideas do, because scientific orthodoxies often are nothing else but religious ideas of another kind. This quote comes from D.M.S. Watson, also in Nature magazine. This fairly old quote, back in 1929. It wasn't even current when I first got it. But he made an interesting statement worth mentioning because it shows a little bit, admits a little bit more than many modern writers do, the bias that really is behind the commitment to evolution. He said, evolution is a theory universally accepted, not because it can be proved by logically coherent evidence to be true, but because the only alternative, special creation, is clearly incredible. I like that kind of honesty, although I think it's kind of blind, but it's kind of nice that he's telling the truth. The reason that evolution is accepted so widely has nothing to do with whether the evidence is in its favor. It has to do with a bigoted religious preference. To say that special creation is clearly incredible, obviously it's not so clearly incredible to people who believe it. It's only clearly incredible to those who are not willing to believe that there is the possibility of the existence of a creator. And since no one has ever been able to prove that there is no such being, nor will they ever be able to prove it because it's not in the realm of science to investigate, there's no reason why special creation should be clearly incredible until someone has found some way to disprove the existence of a creator. But it's interesting that what this says about the strength of the arguments for evolution. They're not very strong at all. And if there wasn't already an a priori rejection of creation, evolution wouldn't have an awful lot of a leg to stand on. It shows that there is a philosophical bent that keeps evolutionary thinking afloat rather than scientific evidence. Now, let me see here. Let's go to this quote by L.T. Moore from the University of Cincinnati. He is quoted by a man named Francis Hitching, who wrote a book called The Neck of the Giraffe, Where Darwin Went Wrong. Although Moore's book is called The Dogma of Evolution. He said, our faith in the doctrine of evolution depends upon our reluctance to accept the antagonistic doctrine of special creation. Again, unusual honesty coming from an evolutionist. He says, our faith in the theory of evolution, he admits it's a faith. And he says, it depends. Now, why didn't he say, it depends on our acceptance of the best evidence available? Because it doesn't. It depends on the continued antagonistic rejection of the opposite viewpoint, which is special creation. There is a battle of worldviews going on here, gang. This is not science in a vacuum. This is not robots without preferences conducting experiments and computers making decisions about what happened from the experiments. These are people with a philosophical preference, a naturalistic philosophical preference, who are simply antagonistic to the idea that there could be a creator. Why they should be antagonistic to that idea, I'm not sure. In fact, that's brought up by Professor Philip Johnson. Of all the people I've quoted, this is the first one who is not an evolutionist. He is a creationist, though he doesn't believe in a literal approach to Genesis chapter 1. He does believe in creationism in some form. He is a professor of law at the University of California in Berkeley. A radical university, of course, and his expertise is not in the area of science, but of law, and he says his book is not written from a scientific viewpoint, but from the viewpoint of one who knows something about logic and arguments, and he does know a great deal about it. If you read his book, it's one of the best books on the subject I've ever found, just published in 1991. It's called Darwin on Trial, significantly, since it's a lawyer writing the book, and basically it's one of the most dispassionate, one of the most even-handed, unemotional treatments of the data I've ever read. It's tremendous. And he's just logical. That's all he is. He looks at the statements of the evolutionists. He considers what kind of logical fallacies are involved here and what they're really basing their views on. And he makes some interesting statements. This is one of them. In his book, Darwin on Trial, on page 113, Professor Philip Johnson says, the essential point of creation has nothing to do with the timing or mechanism the Creator chose to employ, but with the element of design and purpose. In the broadest sense, a creationist is simply a person who believes that the world, and especially mankind, was designed and exists for a purpose. With the issue defined that way, the question becomes, is mainstream science opposed to the possibility that the natural world was designed by a creator for a purpose? If so, on what basis? A very searching question. You see, evolutionists aren't just trying to tell us by what mechanism things developed. It's important for them to say this happened entirely by naturalistic processes without any design and without any purpose. Why do they object to the idea of design and purpose so much? And if they do object to it, on what basis do they object to it? Certainly not a scientific basis, it's a philosophical basis. Evolution rests on philosophical preference, not on demonstration by evidence. Dr. Paul Ehrlich, again, who I quoted earlier, writing jointly with R.W. Holm in Science Journal back in 1962, said, "Perpetuation of today's theory as dogma will not encourage progress toward more satisfactory explanations of the observed phenomena." And I think that's just common sense talking. If you just perpetuate the common orthodoxy that has held sway for the past 130 years since Darwin published his book, without allowing any objections to be considered, why? Because too many men have built their reputations on the acceptance of evolution. You got to remember, these guys are human beings. If a guy has written 40 books and has become the world's most leading expert in some scientific realm, and all of his books have assumed evolution to be a fact, how eager is this guy going to be to entertain evidence that maybe he was all wrong in all of his basic assumptions? I mean, the guy's not going to look too good that way. You either publish or perish. Sometimes if you publish, you'll perish because you publish such idiocy. You publish such bad stuff. And, you know, it's important for the professor that he not only publish, but that what he publishes is never disproven. And this is the catch-22. The guys who are in the position to change the prevailing consensus of scientific opinion are the leading scientists, the ones who are the educators. The problem is they've built their reputation on acceptance of evolution. Therefore, they're not going to be real eager to consider any other alternatives lest they look like they were a little bit wrong or big time wrong. Unfortunately, despite their desperate efforts to salvage their reputation, they're looking pretty bad as the evidence emerges anyway.